Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us here today on this Tuesday morning. We're going to, in the first part of our program here today, cover a lot of territory. We're going to, of course, talk about what happened yesterday at the shipyard in Washington, D.C., and reflect on some things with that. We're going to look at the budget and President Obama and what the battle is going on in Congress and gridlock and what it could lead the rest of us to and why it's there and the economy. And then hopefully try to wind up with what the latest is on Syria and what that means. All that coming up. Right now we turn this over to Beverly Burke, check on the latest in news, bring you our day in history, and jump into our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEA-FM. Reminding you that WEA, support for WEA, is provided by Monroe Shocks and Struts. Information available at monroe.com. Let's look at this day in history before we jump into our conversation and introduce you to our guests. On this day, September 17th, this is the day in 1889 that Claude A. Barnett was born. He was the founder of the Associated Negro Press, one of the great journalists in the early part of this 20th century. This is a day in 1883 that William Carlos Williams, the great poet and pediatrician, was born on this day in 1883, one of my favorites. Chaim Herzog was born on this day, the sixth president of Israel. This was a day in 1923 that Hank Williams was born, the country singer-songwriter we'll leave it there. This is a day in 1935 that Ken Kesey was born, American author. This is a day that Dougie Fresh was born, American rapper and performer, Dougie Fresh. This was a day in 1858 that Dred Scott, the slave who sued for freedom in the Dred Scott versus Sanford case, died. He actually died a free man at the very end of his life. Is a long, tortured history, but one that we've explored a lot on this program. This is a day in 1994, Karl Popper died, a great philosopher. Spiro Agnew, the infamous 39th president of the United States and former Baltimore County executive, died on this day in 1996. And 1997, Red Skelton died. Now, this is a day that's an interesting juxtaposition. 1787, the U.S. Constitution was signed in Philadelphia. And in 1849, Harriet Tubman escaped from slavery. And a lot of people would argue around this Constitution. Some people think in some ways we're still arguing about today, that people argued then, especially in the abolitionist movement. Was the Constitution a document, a pro-slavery document, or was it a document that encourage liberty and freedom throughout the world in this country? And that contradiction is with us to this day, I think. And it's an interesting exposition this today that on that day that Harriet Tubman finally fled and found her freedom from Eastern Shore slavery. This was in 1861 that the first day for the Freedmen's School in Fortress Monroe, Virginia, with a black teacher, Mary Peake. This was a day that the Stern Gang in Israel, the right-wing Zionist gang, killed Count Folke Bernadotte, who was there to mediate peace between Arabs and Israelis in 1948. This is the day that Flip Wilson began his first primetime show starring an African-American male since Nat King Cole in 1970. And on this day, let me get the next page stuck together. That's not good. I apologize. Here we go. This is the day in 1978 the Camp David Accords were signed by Israel and Egypt, which led to why we're talking about Palestine and Israel on this program probably tomorrow. And this is the day in 1980 that the strikes at the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk, Poland, began. The nationwide movement of solidarity was established of workers in Poland this day in 1980. And this is the day in 1983 that Vanessa Williams became the first black Miss America. And in 2011, this is when Occupy Wall Street began on this day, which is probably one of the reasons it's good to have this program today that we're going to have, looking at where America is right now on a number of levels. We're joined in studio here by one of the women who was in that movement in a very deep way, Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's a co-director of OurEconomy.us and co-host of Clearing the Fog radio show. Good to have you back, Margaret.
Thank you, Mark.
We're here also with Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead. Kay Whitehead is Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University. Good to have you here with us in the studio.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
And we are also joined here in studio by Dr. Steve Nisberg. Steve is Associate Professor of Finance at the American School of Business at the University of Baltimore. Welcome back, Steve.
Nice to be here, Mark. Thanks.
And Lyndon McAllister joins us by phone, author, conservative media personality, and public speaker. And Lenny, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, as always, Mark.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, and I will look at the Facebook pages. I missed a couple of things there yesterday. We won't let that happen today. But 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let me just start. I think we have to start just in terms of where the news is today and what people are talking about is Aaron Alexis, who killed at least 12, I hear maybe 13 people now, at the Naval Shipyard. And the complexity of that situation, both in terms of violence in America and this kind of continue kind of mass killings we keep erupting in our country. And more is coming out about him, that he called himself a Buddhist, that he was deeply involved in Thai culture, that he was in the United States Navy for 3 years, aviation electronics made third class, that he was said to have been part of the 9/11 rescue by his father, that he suffered from post-traumatic stress 2 days before, several days before, or a week before, I'm not quite sure the time, but he went to the Veterans Hospital saying he was hearing multiple voices, that he'd been arrested twice for firing off his gun, once in his apartment, neither time prosecuted, saying the gun went off by accident when it went through the ceiling of his apartment, another time where he shot in anger a neighbor's tires. But the police in Seattle didn't file charges there then either. And I just reflect on what this says to you all, plus the argument taking place, of course, now raging between left and right wing radio, or liberal, I should say, and conservative radio in America, over gun control. That is too much easy access to guns in a country in a violent culture. That it's too easy for people who are mentally ill to get guns in this country to do harm to themselves or others. On the other hand, people argue on the other side, well, if you know, most people in America who have guns, whether they have one gun or 50 guns, don't commit murders and don't shoot people. So and in some ways, both sides are telling the truth. Doesn't mean we have figured out how to resolve the issue. So what does this all say to you all? Kay, go ahead.
I wanted to add one other thing that's come out about Aaron Alexis, of course, that he was an African-American. And that is the point that quite a few people that I've been talking to, that they get stuck on. They were very concerned. My mother actually said, I was hoping that he wouldn't be African-American, even though when I remind her that 66% of the mass shootings that have occurred in this country since 1982 have been committed by folks who are not African-Americans, by whites, she said, but if you hear the news and you study the news, you would think there's an overwhelming amount that 100% of them are committed by African-Americans. So that's one other piece that kind of becomes a part of this conversation. When you think about Obama's comments after Trayvon Martin, you think about all of the energy and tension still around the Trayvon Martin incident. There's still this idea of perceived criminality, of what happened in North Carolina this weekend with the African-American being shot as he was running towards the police, presumably for help after an accident. Mm-hmm. So we have all of this kind of swirling around because you add this layer of race, which I believe convolutes the issue, because if you focus on his race, then you don't focus on the fact that he might have been bipolar. He may have been hearing voices. He may have been suffering from PTSD, some of the bigger issues that we have yet to deal with in this country around mental health.
Yeah, I think that...
Margaret Flowers.
Thank you. We need to put this in the bigger context of what's happening in this country, and it all ties into the financial crash, 2008, and the situation that we're living in, increasing poverty, lack of access to health care, lack of ability to afford education, debt. We're seeing an increased number of suicides in this country. We're seeing, we have a real mental health crisis, and people are not able to get the health care that they need for that. And so, you know, when you put it in the broader context of kind of the dysfunctional society that we live in and the lack of social support for people, then, yeah, guns are a huge problem. Easy access to guns are a huge problem because you're going to have situations like this. So if we really want to address things, it's not about just controlling guns. It's about let's deal with the deeper issues that are going on in this country, which is, you know, the institutionalized racism as well as part of that, the financial, situation that we have, the real degradation of people in this country because they aren't supported. They don't have their basic needs met. So I think we need to address those first.
Lenny?
You know, I was sitting there listening to the ladies speak, and I agree with them 100%. I was listening to you, Mark, as well. And the thought hit me. What's the difference between the 1950s and 60s in our modern times over the last 5 to 10 years or so?
Yeah.
And the difference is the only real difference is that you in the 50s and 60s had civil rights leaders and even a president and a senator and other leaders shot, where the people were protesting and they went through their violence, but there were leaders that were shot. Nowadays, you trade that for the mass shootings. If you make that one-for-one trade, almost everything else is the same. Mm-hmm. You have more of an economic crisis going on now. You have the laws rolling us back and the society rolling us back to more racial tension. We're starting to divide ourselves, not come together. And there's world tension from what we're seeing in Syria to what we went through with North Korea to the tensions with Iran to us being in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are so many parallels. But 60 and all that upheaval.
So
your Kennedys and Kings being shot versus your Sandy Hooks and now the Navy Yard and other instances like that, Aurora again in Arizona. We have to figure out.
Lenny, we're losing you. You're going in and out. Is that us?
Sorry. We have to figure out how to get through these turbulent times like they got through those turbulent times in the 60s to make America a better nation.
Steve.
Well, it's interesting. I think it starts with the whole question of our context and how we look at each other as human beings. You know, when I heard about this, I heard about it on the radio. I didn't recognize that this was an African-American. And that, quite honestly, didn't matter to me. It was obvious that here was someone who, you know, is a hurting human being for whatever reason. And that human being lives in a community, and he's surrounded by people. And where was the breakdown that allowed this to happen? You know, was the breakdown institutional? Was it in our healthcare system? Or was the breakdown more in our family and community structure? You know, why wasn't this recognized? Why didn't he have friends that kept him from doing this? You know, where was the support network for one human being coming from other human beings? That's an interesting question.
Maybe it's everything you've said is all the above.
I just want to add that I think it's interesting that Steve talked about the fact that when you heard he was an African-American, that was beside the point. Beside the point that he was an African-American, unfortunately, for me, it was a part of the discussion. Because what happened with Adam Lanza, there wasn't an all-out attack against white American males at that point. But when incidences like this happen and they involve African-American males, it does become more dangerous for other African-American males. Unfortunately, it is always a part of the discussion, particularly if you're raising African-American males or if you're married to an African-American male, because it does translate into what's happening in our society.
And let me throw this out here. Let's go to the phones and open up here at 410-319-8888. I mean, I think that you've all touched on things that are all part and parcel of this. And when you were talking about what happened in the 1950s a second ago, Lenny, it made me think of a conversation we were having in the green room before anybody got here that Steve and I were saying. I said, some of the stuff does go back to the 50s, and that's when we were living in a time, one positive and negative, maybe both positive on some levels, but I don't think so. Exploded in America. One was this mythological economic growth when America was the imperial king of the planet Earth from 1946 to the 1970s. And there was this kind of middle class power growing in America and things felt stable, quote unquote, in America. And that's been torn asunder and we have not been able to figure out how to put it back together at all. It was also a time when segregation was attacked and destroyed, legal segregation in America. And America had to come to grips with both issues of poverty and race and racism that it never did before in its history in the way we're doing now. So both of the things together, we kind of have a country that has kind of been blown apart in the 50s and 60s, and we as a nation don't know how to pull it together. And so part of it is you see this gigantic schism between right and left and people just confused and hurt and not taking care of human beings like this young man. So it was both, you know, like it was both a combination of our mental health system failing, people failing to take care of him and his mental illness, and it also was community. I mean, I can remember very quickly, I'll stop you and go to the phones. I'll let you all talk to them and go to the phones. Years back, there was a friend of mine who suffered from post-traumatic stress and from NAM, and when he was about to lose it completely, and we knew it, well, the people gathered around him, put him on a plane with him, took him to a veterans hospital, and took him there. Said, you got to take care of a friend. And that doesn't happen enough in this society, you know, that and so both things are true. that we've kind of lost our bearing on many levels. Maybe I'm taking it too far. Margaret, you're looking about to say something, were you?
Well, no, I mean, I think that I was struck when you said that we don't know how to put things back together again.
You think we do?
I think that the people do. I think that I believe in the power of the people, that they came together, and that's what we saw in Occupy Wall Street. That people do know at the gut level what the solutions are, and there's kind of all this stuff that's happening below the surface that's not getting attention in the media, and unfortunately we do have a very dysfunctional political system that is really an obstacle to getting the things done that, you know, I guess I'm thinking about. You know, we did a show yesterday with three impressive people from Occupy Wall Street who are working in different areas. One has been working with or documenting families and communities that are fighting evictions, but they're also moving towards building more community land trusts to take back control of you know, land and create affordable housing. Another is very involved in the Occupy Sandy relief efforts and trying to make sure that that doesn't just become a gentrification effort, and that there's, you know, real building those communities back up in a strong and lasting way and building more cooperative businesses. Mm-hmm. Another that's creating a whole cooperative financial system to offer financial services to people that don't have bank accounts. You know, we have a severe problem of unbanked and underbanked people in this country. And those are things that you don't hear about, but those are all solutions that are really happening under the surface. And so I think that I think we need to start believing in our collective wisdom a little bit more in this country and coming together to solve these problems, because we do know how to do it.
But here's a challenge. The challenge is,
Lenny McAllister,
while the people do have the solutions that we don't hear about that may be underneath the surface, you mentioned a dysfunctional political system.
Right.
Politics is a... And the people, five people or five...
we're losing you. Right.
All these people in the office, and when people walk away from politics and say it's too dysfunctional, I don't want to get involved, they are allowing this to continue. If what we saw in the 60s were a generation of strong leaders, they are now in their 70s and 80s and 90s, and that many of them have left this earth. Where is that young generation of leaders from 25 to 50 that are going?
Then you're going in. Mark's going to hang up for a minute and let Mark Henry call you right back in a different line.
Steve? No problem.
Steve?
Well, the interesting thing about your story is that, you know, here you and a group of this gentleman's friends actually put yourselves aside for the moment. You got him on a plane. You obviously, you know, you took part of yourself and put it aside to do this. You took your time. You took your money. You took care of a friend. And, you know, more and more and more we see the attitude in this country, well, you know, okay, that guy's problems are not my problems. Okay, and you know, because we've made so many attempts to solve problems through government, for example, you know, we've kind of abdicated our responsibilities to our brothers and sisters, to our neighbors, to our family members. You know, we've abdicated those responsibilities. And we got to look at, well, what has caused that? You know, what is it about ourselves that allows us to just so casually disregard those responsibilities as individuals and as a society? And how can we get back to that point where we start taking responsibility for each other at the individual level? Okay. When's that going to happen?
I'm sorry, Steve.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with what has been said, but I think that we should look to redefine what community means. I mean, when you think about one of the biggest mass movements in our country that was extremely successful, the Civil Rights Movement down in the South, there was a strong idea of what community meant, that we were all in this together working for one big goal. And I can't wait till we talk about Occupy, because that was one of the concerns that people have. Who gets involved? Who is part of this movement? What issues are we focusing on? Yes, we're talking about the 99% versus the 1%, but what about the other issues that we are facing around community, around the urban environment, around what's happening in terms of literacy in our schools? Do we have so many issues that we have to deal with that we have multiple ideas of community because we can't unite under one big banner of, say, breaking down the walls of discrimination? I also want to just disagree with Dr. Flowers who talked about this movement happening underneath the surface. I think because of the internet, and I teach this in my classroom, I don't think things are underneath the surface anymore. I think that with Twitter and with Facebook and with social media, that it's very easy to tap into these multiple movements that are happening, which say with the civil rights movement, you would wait and read about it in the paper, or you would have word of mouth, or you would go to church. Now you just go to the right Twitter feed and you can find out everything that's happening. So it's no longer underneath the surface. I think it's maybe running along the surface.
I didn't want to get the calls right away, but describe what you mean by under the surface, Margaret.
Well, I guess it's not something that's talked about widely in the corporate media. You know,
you don't see it in the media.
But fortunately, they're losing their credibility, and we have a growing citizens' media and social media, which is taking
that place.
Which is great. But in terms of breaking really into the mainstream political or public dialogue, I don't think it's quite there yet.
Let's see what our listeners are thinking at 410-319-8888. And Eugene in Nottingham, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, Eugene. Welcome.
I just want to make a comment in regards to family, and I always hear frequently talk about leaders and role models. My belief personally is that that starts at home. And as a kid, your parents, your siblings, guardians, people that develop you and shape your character, those are your leaders, and those are the people that you look towards for guidance as a youth. And then as you grow older, you develop your own standard of how you want to live and what you want to be. Even watching the Steelers, and I was a big Lynn Swann fan, me, Joe Green, Willie Stargell of the Pirates, what have you, I knew the difference between an athlete performing and my parents at home taking care of me and making sure that I was okay. And I think that if you're not getting a solid foundation at home, if you're not being taught the basics of survival and respect and just understanding that there are rules to follow, That and if you do follow them, then as you get older, you'll be prepared for life. I don't think you can just overlook the basic foundation of family. And I think if you don't have that, whether it's your parents or your uncles or aunts or grandparents, somebody has to take care of you and teach you and develop your character. Because what we see now today is people, I think, with character flaws, major character flaws, that won't allow the ability to recover from mistakes or to adjust the things that don't go their way. You know, you can't give up or just destroy people when things aren't going your way. You have to be patient and know that in the end, it's going to work out. And I just think that the family foundation is gone.
Okay.
And without that, it's done.
Eugene, I think you're raising an interesting issue here. This is a constant discussion on this program and every other place you have, which is this balance between the conversation, we put it on the family. The family's not what it was, and so you don't raise people in a clear way, or the other side saying that, no, this is there are larger social issues around race and class that are affecting people's behavior that as well, and not looking at how the social underpinnings affect family, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So, I mean, this is, to me, always a really interesting portion.
Yeah, I mean, as a pediatrician, of course, I believe in strong families. I think that, that's where you kind of begin shaping your view of kind of the world. But in our current situation in this country, it's so hard for people to make it. And our kind of financial system, the way that we prioritize the whole this whole myth of this American way of life and this rugged individualism and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I think all of this combines to make it really hard for families. You know, when you're having to work multiple jobs to feed your family, when you're being preyed upon constantly by people that are trying to profit from you at every turn, it's a difficult environment. And I think that I actually disagree a little bit with teaching our children that if they just obey the rules, everything's going to be okay, because that doesn't work anymore in this country. And I work with a lot of young people who were smart, who tried to go to school, and they find that they can't afford their education, or even if they did, they can't get a job to pay it off. And they're really, they see a very bleak future. And that's something that we've allowed to happen.
Steve, you're going to say what?
Yeah, I don't think it has as much to do with breaking the rules as it does to, setting a personal standard of behavior, moral behavior, ethical behavior. Interesting study was done a few years ago. They looked at Mother's and Father's Day cards coming out of prisons. And on Mother's Day, they counted up the number of Mother's Day cards coming out of prisons, and there were quite a few being sent to mothers. And then come Father's Day, they counted, and none were being sent. And, the absence of that father-son relationship has been shown to you know, increase the likelihood that the son will be involved in some kind of criminal activity and go awry. Because there's, you know, there's no example being set. There's no standard being set there. And, you know, the breakdown of the family in this country, I think, is an interactive issue. I don't think it boils down to one thing or another. There are social policies that have influenced that. There are economics that have influenced that. But we've allowed too many people to again, abdicate their responsibilities. And, you know, when you don't have a standard of responsibility being taught, you can't expect people to act responsibly down the road because they've never been given a standard of responsibility. And we see that again and again and again. A lot of what we're suffering from now is just a result of unmitigated self-interested behavior where people just have license to go out and do what they want to do for their own selfishness.
We have to take a brief break and come back. We'll go to the phones and let Kay have a quick say, and then we're going to kind of – I want to see how all this fits into the crisis we're facing in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill at this moment, facing the future of the nation. We're going to tackle that when we come back. In terms of what we've just been talking about here, stay with us, 410-319-8888. Read your comments coming in on Facebook, and Benjamin and James are the next callers up. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here with Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead, who is Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, Dr. Stephen Isberg, who is Associate Professor of Finance at the Merrick School of Business at the University of Baltimore, Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of itsoureconomy.us, and co-host of the radio show Clearing the Fog, and Lennon McAllister, author, conservative media personality, public speaker. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to Facebook and read a piece from Sammy Lahock, who just wrote to our Facebook page. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Nothing is tweeted yet, but if you – oh, there's some Twitter there. Let's see what it says. Okay, good. Check that out. And 410-319-8888. Let's go to Benjamin, then we'll move back to our panel. Benjamin, welcome.
It's the conversation here. As I understand, this gentleman was probably going through some trials because he had a general discharge, general conduct, meaning that he had a conduct problem. If we really had issues at hand, now, I'm 62, it'd be 63 soon, but the idea is this. I have some real deep issues with people that's under pressure that don't have Christ. You must have a family root tree. My mother and father taught me, if you earn it, it's yours. If you got, you can keep getting. Long as you keep getting, you're okay. This gentleman was cut loose, I think, out of the military, and he decided to go back and take it out on whatever happened in the Navy Yard. I worked in that area for a time, from Collar Rock back down to the Navy Yard, from the Navy Annapolis back down to the Union Station, taking people to their positions that they had. Now, I didn't never thought that someone could go in that tight security place and do what was done. Apparently, this gentleman had some issues real deep and emotional that killed 12 people and wounded so many more. That's a tight area down there. Mark, I could be angry with a lot of things that have happened in my life, but my mother taught me values. My father taught me values. My father, they had 14 children, and all of them, too. My point is this, 88 and 84, 67 years of marriage, it's a unity tree that if you don't have it, it's not there. You must be born, raised through the Spirit of God, so therefore you do not go out. This is the time for people to look at these issues because you don't know who you're walking around now. That's okay. Some subject that might go off snapshot. And you go off at someone, they're going to tell you, oh, he had this, he had that. Something happened. He'd been running from state to state to state to state, and he still had that problem. They got to get that problem solved right in the same state it started. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, James.
I just moved in this area. I'm going to give you a donation, but God bless you all because this is a good program, and I think that we can deal something to get mature people to start dealing with the issues. I see some things happen with the getting the kids off the block. If the kids come off the block early, they don't get in trouble. They can start values by learning.
James,
I want to get back to you, Mark. God bless you.
Thank you. Kay, you have a response?
Oh, I definitely want to first thank the caller and what he brought about in terms of talking about the family structure. And we can continue to talk about the breakdown of the family, and you talk about it a lot on this show. That's just yet another problem that we have in our society that we're still trying to figure out solutions to it, along with everything else. I do think that we need to recognize the difference between the tensions around these daily national microaggressions, whether it's living in a food desert, whether it's going to a school that has bars on the windows, whether it's the fact that the parents are working multiple jobs just to live in a low-income neighborhood, versus mental illness. I think those are two separate issues, and sometimes we collapse those as if the two are the same, and it's not. If you're frustrated about the fact that you don't have enough money to pay your bills, or your son can't get new tennis shoes, or your daughter can't read, that's a different kind of frustration than the next level, where you're talking about picking up a gun and hurting everyone in your environment,
right,
to show the world how upset you are. I also think it's important, as we begin to study the family more in detail, that we also begin to look at the long-term effects of exposing our children to violent video games and misogynistic rap lyrics. I think that there are so many issues other than just the family breaking down that we're not exploring. We're looking for a quick fix, and I don't think there's a quick fix to this long-term problem.
Well, and what's making us choose to do that, Kay? I mean, what's making us choose to spend our time in those video games?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's driving those choices?
Yes, I agree.
You know, this is valuable time, the gift of time we have.
Not all choices are always things that we choose on our own, I think.
Exactly. Well, I just think about, you know, when I practiced for 15 years in pediatrics, and some of my families, you know, when I would ask, you know, did the kids have time outside to play, they didn't, because they didn't live at, parents didn't feel comfortable. They were working, you know, long hours, and the kids basically came home and were instructed to stay inside the house where it was safe. And so, you know, that's a whole nother piece of this picture. But I agree with you. It's a multifactorial picture, and there is a difference between diagnosable mental illness, which it sounds like this gentleman had, if he was hearing voices and possibly suffering from PTSD. But we also need to look, the whole bigger picture of mental health is that we're also, in our society, 70% of people in the United States are on prescription drugs.
Yes.
And we are really prescribing ourselves to be able to deal with this dysfunctional society that we live in, instead of addressing the deeper issues of why our society is the way it is. I mean, I agree with you, Steve, that we need to build community. That's really at the root of what humans need. It's, you know, it's part of our DNA to live in a communal society, and our society isolates. And so one of the psychologists I work with, Bruce Levine, writes that we're kind of, as physicians, part of the problem when we, instead of saying to our patients, yeah, you're right, you shouldn't have to be working this many jobs, you know, you should be able to have education for your children. Instead, we just, you know, tell them, you know, take this medicine and go out there and keep dealing with this dysfunctional society.
I completely agree with you.
So, go ahead.
Mark, if I may,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a couple things that I wanted to address. Number one, the caller has a valid point. We all need to place God back in our society. But, you know, the bottom line is the Klan burns crosses, and they've been blowing people up. They blew up little girls at a church. So it's not as though we just incorporating people that are exposed to church is going to reduce this violence. We've been a very violent society from its outset, with religious leaders all throughout. We need people that are going to fix the secular problems that we have. The truth of the matter is, as much as we need community, we also need to be able to take care of ourselves. We need to be able to take care of our families. We need to make sure that our children are safe. So we could talk all this stuff about violent video games. Guess what? Bugs Bunny was blowing people up in the 1940s in cartoons.
Which is not okay, by the way.
Well, I'm not saying it is. What I'm saying, though, is that it's been a constant. So it's not as though we just started seeing violent video games just in 2013. We all played Space Invaders. We all played other games. There was Cowboys and Indians. We've always had violence in our society. What is going on now, though, is we're starting to see the American society divide itself. Once again, we're in very hard economic times, number two. Number three, the world has shrunk through social media, through the society being faster, and through technology. The world has shrunk. So now, rather than being isolated and frustrated where you may take it out and you have these, undocumented cases of domestic violence, which we don't talk about, especially during these hard economic times, now people have access to guns. We're in a smaller society. You can literally go on Facebook and see a picture of somebody saying, I got in a fight with my wife, I shot her, here she is dead. And there's the picture of her posted on Facebook. That's what's shocking us now. But in regards to the violence, in regards to the frustration, it's been the same. So how do we fix the secular issues that are leading to the breakdown of the American society in the 21st century?
Okay, very quick, because I do want to move into those issues. And
I just want to just add that there's definitely a difference between watching the Bugs Bunny cartoon or going outside and playing an imaginary game of cowboys and Indians and sitting in front of a video game and you are simulating shooting and killing people, beating up women, chopping off their heads. There is a difference.
It's
and the impact.
No,
it is not the same thing. It's not the same thing.
When
you talk about sitting in front of a violent video game, it's not the same thing.
I have to jump in the middle. And radio, when we talk over each other, we'll just turn the radios off.
Sorry. And we don't want them to do that.
And we don't want them to do that. And we can't hear each other. So, and I think that what about the secular aspect of this? Let me just read something. Maybe kind of a diversion of what we're talking about, but let me just read it since somebody wrote this in on Facebook. Since we're also talking about Occupy Wall Street, the budget crisis we're facing, how what the government's doing is affecting where the society is now, and the anniversary of the meltdown that was just the other day. Sammy Lehak wrote in, Lehman Brothers was the only Wall Street bank that didn't get a bailout from their government. They knew that all the subprime mortgages, credit default swaps, they sold to earn Eurozone banks were toxic. The British government played it dirty by not allowing Barclays to take over Lehman. The Eurozone economies took the biggest hit. And then just the other day we saw the front page of the New York Times talking about now we're kind of working in the futures and derivatives when it comes to ethanol prices that are driving up the cost of gasoline in America. Not illegal, but it's unregulated completely. So here we are facing a budget crisis in America that in some ways is directly related to the social and cultural malaise that people find themselves in. I am conflating the two for a moment.
What word did you just use? You're what?
So because we are facing this piece in Washington D.C. right now.
You know, I got to tie what you just referred to into what Kay was just saying about there is a difference between that video game and Bugs Bunny. And you know, when I'm listening to Kay, I'm thinking, you know, that video game is about power.
Yeah.
And, you know, we live in a country that, you know, we boast about our freedom in this country. You know, if you look at, you know, any time that we need to rally the troops, wave the flag, what do we talk about? We talk about the banner of freedom. And, you know, what does freedom mean? Freedom does not mean that you're free to do the wrong thing. Freedom does not mean you're free to do whatever you want, whenever you want, because there's always there can be a cost to that. And, you know, if you talk about the Wall Street situation, and, you know, the notion that, you know, when you listen to what Wall Street's message is, hey, we're in a free society. This is a free market. This is competitive. You get out there and you engage in your own self-interested behavior. And the problem with Wall Street is that self-interested behavior has just become so unmitigated and led to so much power that it's actually corrupted them to the point where, as far as I'm concerned, that it corrupted them to beyond the point of no return. I really think that, you know, the danger that we face as a society right now is that those institutions are going to collapse. We've already seen them collapse 2 and 3 times. They've been collapsing since the mid-1800s, steadily. And the collapses get bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually we're going to reach the point where we just can't bail them out anymore. And, you know, each time we bail them out, what we tend to see is more of a stratification in the welfare of individuals in this country. We see, you know, that income gap that people keep talking about is widening and widening as we speak. If you look at the upper income deciles and the lower income deciles and wage earners, I mean, that gap is widening. And there are people that are getting left out. And that's why we're seeing people take to the streets, because they're realizing, hey, this outcome, there's some lack of justice here.
It's a rigged system.
You know?
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to try to figure out what issues we should tackle. I definitely don't want to get into a big debate about this, and thank you for stepping in, Mark, because it's almost as if we're arguing apples and oranges. Are they violent? Are they too violent? How much violence? How long should we have violence when we have so many issues that we need to deal with? I think about my my other colleagues here, and the fact that they work on the economy and study the economy. I don't. So I'm trying to follow everything that's happening in the newspaper. I'm trying to grab every article that I can, trying to figure out, as the banks and the businesses continue to collapse, I want to know how it's going to translate into how much money I bring home.
Right.
I want to know whether or not it's going to impact whether my son is able to play football because I need money to pay for his fees, or whether or not we can have, you know, steak versus, you know, beans and potatoes. And I think for a number of Americans that don't study the economy at the level that the other guests do, we want to know what it means for our paycheck. How many jobs do we have to take on to continue with the lifestyle we have now? We're not talking about the lifestyle, say, like the CEO of Panera Bread, who I think is interesting. He's taking the SNAP challenge this week, like Cory Booker did. So he's living off $4.50 a day to see what that's like. Not to that level, not to that extent, but trying to maintain the lifestyle you have now. You're doing the same work, you're working the same number of hours, but yet you're no longer able to afford the things you could afford a year ago or two years ago.
Right.
Let Margaret jump in, then Lenny, you come in.
Great,
Margaret.
Thanks. Okay. So just quickly to respond to Steve in terms of, you know, we're going to see another economic collapse, and the amount of derivatives that's out there right now is really scary because after the bailout, banks were required to create kind of a living will, and what they've done is the Cyprus model of a bail-in. So we're all at a huge risk if when the next financial crisis occurs, our money that's in the bank may be worth really nothing. So that's of concern. And then to Kay's point about this kind of, I think we have to bring it back to the big picture. When you said, you know, what is the issue that we're fighting about? Well, that was my concern. As working for healthcare, how do we get a health system for everyone? Well, the fact is that the healthcare is part of the bigger social and economic justice movement. It's if you don't address that, we can't fix healthcare in this country. So what I think the bigger picture of what we're all fighting, And there have to be other social conversations about equality and institutional racism and those things. But the bigger picture is we're trying to get the money out of the system so that the people are able to participate in the decisions about the things that affect their lives and have some control over what's going on, so that everything is not about is being driven by Wall Street as it is right now. And so we have to identify areas where we can make a difference and start to change the system, because we're up against this huge behemoth, you know, this wealth inequality, and it's the ones at the top that are controlling all of the levers, and we just continually get more and more screwed. So for me, the biggest kind of most pressing issue is this issue of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this agreement, which is basically going to take away our national sovereignty and allow transnational corporations to sue nations over their laws if they affect that corporation's profits. And this is something that we can stop. We're already slowing it down, and we think that we can stop it completely. And so this is actually bringing a lot of groups together. It's bringing together people that care about food, jobs, healthcare, education, the environment. So it's trying to right now see that we're all part, all of our issues are connected. We're all part of this same movement. And how do we start working together in strategic ways to start knocking down some of these pillars and start shifting the power back towards the people in a more participatory democratic process?
Yeah, and it's very important to remember, too, that since this crisis, the banking industry itself has consolidated even more than it ever has been. You have a smaller number of very large and powerful agencies who have done a very good job at stalling any attempt to regulate it. I mean, if you take a look at where Dodd-Frank is today, it's not much further along than it was 5 years ago. And other industries are experiencing major consolidation. And what's enabling this? Well, you know, the Fed's been going out and buying $85 billion worth of bonds a month and pushing this cash into the economy, and it's out there to be borrowed at 2 and 3%. And it's being used to consolidate not only wealth, but the control of assets and resources in this country. And you are up against what amounts to be a behemoth. It's no longer a fair game, and it's no longer a true free market in that regard.
Lenny, jump in. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and that's okay. If I may, I want to get back to what was being said previously about all the issues that we have in America. It goes back to what one of your guests was saying earlier, which is, what's the bottom line for each American family? And that's where the role of government comes into play, because we do have a lot of issues that we're facing in the American society. But if we can construct policies that will allow that American family to sustain and begin to thrive once again, the other issues will begin to take care of themselves. If you have more economic stability, even if the family structure doesn't stay in play, now you still have two working parents that can go to court, make sure that they have joint custody of their kids, whether they ever married or not, so that that child or children still have two active parents in their lives. I mean, there's a study that says that most African-American children do not have their fathers in their homes, but there's also a study that says that when that father is involved with those children, if he's not in the home, he is more involved as an African-American father than any other ethnicity right. in America as well. So when you take all those things into consideration, if you can provide the economic stability, parents and Americans can take care of the schools. They can put the heat on the schools. They can make sure that the communities are better taken care of. But we got to make sure that they have the resources first and foremost to take care of themselves.
So,
and the rest of the stuff will start being taken care of.
Let me talk about what's going on Capitol Hill right now and kind of wrap this into this piece. Because what we're talking about here is what in the last 10 minutes of this conversation about what Lenny was just saying and what does fix this. I mean, right. one of the things I was looking at this article yesterday about the coming crisis, economic crisis we may be facing that Margaret alluded to and you alluded to, Steve, a moment ago. And I'll just read them real quickly. That our shadow banking system is still gigantic. $9 trillion still going through that system, completely unregulated. Nobody's controlling it. The banks are bigger than ever. That they are doing these reckless things that I talked about earlier, like the ethanol buying that's
right,
taking place,
right.
Ethanol credit buying that's taking place, that nobody is covering, that are shooting up the cost of our gasoline, that we are seeing derivatives unregulated
mm-hmm.
that caused this crisis in the beginning, and nobody was punished in the last crisis at
right.
all for creating this economic disaster we face. So how does that fit into what we've been talking about, and how does that fit into the battle going on right now in the U.S. Congress around this kind of budget crisis, whether or not we're going to have a government to pay for anything?
You know, I agree with Lenny that, you know, if we had policies that put people back on their feet, that we could move forward. But unfortunately, in this political system, we're just not seeing any interest in those types of policies. And it's the same thing around this whole what's happening with the budget and the money that, you know, the QE stuff that's going on with the Federal Reserve. You know, none of that money is getting to the people and addressing their needs. None of our policies are adequately addressing the needs of our people, and that's because of the dysfunctionality of our political system, because of the people that have the wealth are the ones that are controlling the levers. So I just we have to see this as part of the bigger picture of what's being pushed, which is this neoliberal economic agenda that we've pushed on other countries around the world, and now it's being pushed, you know, in earnest here at home against our own people. And start fighting back against that. And there is a strong movement that's trying to fight, that's trying to take back the commons, take back control of property, build jobs that are sustainable, you know, that are models where the workers have control over those jobs, that are pushing for public forms of financing like public banking and participatory budgeting at the local level. And I think those are the efforts that we have to push for, because it's going to take a movement to make any kind of change in what happens in Congress. None of what they're doing has to be done. We have solutions to all of these crises. We have a manufactured deficit crisis, and it's part of their agenda to defund and privatize.
So let me just push by. Do we think, is it completely manufactured, this crisis, or is it real?
Oh, I think it's very real.
Yeah. It feels real.
It's a very real crisis. Now, you know, I think that, Margaret, I'd have to hear a little bit more about your perspective on how this is manufactured, and I think I have an intuitive understanding of what you're saying, in the sense that it doesn't have to be as bad as it is. But I think it goes a lot. I think it's a real problem. It's a real problem.
No, I was just thinking that it would be good to come up with some real solutions. I know it's a real problem. I do agree with what Margaret was saying. But people are interested in solutions. What do we do? What do we do to solve all of these problems? I mean, I want to solve all the problems of the world. I just know I can't do it by myself, and I definitely can't do it before lunch. So I need some help. I need to figure out, what do I focus on first? Do I focus on the family first, the community first, you know, gang violence first, the economy first, going to work? Like, how do I focus on all of these issues? And I think one of the things that's missing now, which makes me think about the civil rights movement, is having some clear and concise leaders in place to kind of push us towards what some of the solutions could be to problems.
That's a lot of what our work is through PopularResistance.org, is to give people that information and those tools. And a lot of it is what we're encouraging is you need to come together at your community level and start talking about the issues that are facing you in your community. And then there's lots of models out there for addressing them, depending on what's the most pressing crisis. And I won't go into it because that could be a whole show.
It could be. Go ahead, Lenny.
The truth of the matter is, if you do not change the laws, if people that impact laws in a very tangible way, where that is their job, if you don't change that, it doesn't matter what we do at the community level. Therefore, you need to have those leaders in positions to influence laws very directly. And that's what we have to start looking at now. And again, it goes back to what we were saying about the civil rights movement. We have to have clear, concise leadership that loves the people and loves us getting forward like we used to have in the 50s and 60s versus what we have today, which is basically right versus left, not right versus wrong.
Except that, let me just push back a little bit on this whole idea. I mean, we only have a few minutes left here, so we don't have time to do it today, but I think it's important, maybe in a further discussion, is that we keep going back in the 50s and 60s. The movement in the 50s had a clear goal, was to end segregation. And the leaders, for the most part, like Martin Luther King at the time, were reluctant to be leaders. They had to be pushed into the roles they were in. It was the people who pushed the movement in Alabama, not Martin Luther King.
Yeah. Right.
And so it's there is always this, there is relations between leadership and the people, always has been, always will be.
But
we have this misnomer, I think, that it's just the leaders who are leading the way when it's just much more
the movement
more
that's
of a,
driving the leaders.
It's a dynamic between the two.
Yeah. Because the leaders also understand what the cost of that leadership's going to be.
Right. But the movement does propel people to leadership, and those people do become the spokespeople for some of the bigger issues. So though it was the kids in North Carolina who sat down, though it was the four little girls that became martyrs for us, that did propel people into leadership. And I do think there has to be some voices who are speaking and covering these issues for the people. I mean, I think we always wax nostalgically about the 50s and the 60s. Like Gil Scott-Heron says, we all want to go back as far as we can, even if it's just to yesterday. But I think we sometimes forget how dangerous that time was, how much tension was involved, how many people died to get us to where we are. Are people prepared to put their lives on the line?
Freedom's
if you want to be a leader, are you prepared to go to jail? Yeah. That's what Dr. King said.
The answer to that, number one, is no. We need more people to have more courage to do everything that it takes to change things. But number two, I think what we also forget, I know that you're saying that the people push the leaders, but look in the 1950s and 60s, what ended up happening with those individuals in the 70s? Bobby Rush went from a Black Panther to a Chicago alderman to a congressman. You look at John Lewis, he went from getting hit upside the head on a bridge to being a congressman. You look at Andrew Young. He went from civil rights and being a protester to being an ambassador and a mayor. These people did move into leadership positions where laws were created to secure the gains that were made. We don't have that at the same level right now, which is why I keep saying, if you can't touch the laws, we are merely protesting for the sake of hearing our voices, not moving us forward.
Well, we also have an abundance of wealth in this country and the ability to create even more. And, the people who are in control of that wealth really need to literally get down on their knees and give thanks and be better stewards of that and start to serve others with it instead of serving themselves.
I just wanted to very quickly to Lanny. I mean, that was where I went. I went into that system to try to change it better for healthcare. And what I found is that the only way that I could affect any change was through nonviolent direct action. And that's why that's what I've switched gears to. It's why we have popularresistance.org. We do have a clear vision as ending the rule of money. And so if people go to popularresistance.org, you'll see that there is a vibrant movement out there and what people are doing and how you can plug into it. But that's system. We've got to switch the power a little bit first before we can expect laws to be put into place that serve our interests.
And for today, that's the last comment for the day. And I want to thank all of you. That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, Dr. Stephen Isberg before that, Lenny McAllister before that, and Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead before that. Thank the four of you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Mark. God bless you all.
And we'll take more about the shots of this tomorrow and continue our conversation with you all. And right now we're going to take a break, come back, and look at our weekly feature soundbites, the future of our food system.